main problem that I'm writing about in the book is what happens when we take these particular irrational fears and we normalize them, and then we criminalize in different ways people who don't sort of adhere to that fear.
That was Kim Brooks on Psychologists Off the Clock.
We are three clinical psychologists committed to cutting-edge, integrative, and evidence-based strategies for living well.
On this podcast, we bring you ideas from psychology that can help you flourish in your work, parenting, relationships, and health.
I am Dr. Diana Hill, practicing in Seaside, Santa Barbara, California.
I'm Dr. Debbie Sorensen, practicing in Mile High, Denver, Colorado.
And from coast to coast, I'm Dr. Yael Schoenbrunn, a Boston-based clinical psychologist and assistant professor at Brown University.
We hope this podcast offers you ideas for how to live a full and meaningful life.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock.
Today, I am speaking with author of Small Animals, Parenthood in the Age of Fear, Kim Brooks. Small Animals was an NPR Best Book of the Year and described by National Book Review as a, quote, impassioned, smart work of social criticism and a call for support and empathy. Kim's writing has appeared in the New York Times, in New York Magazine, Salon, and BuzzFeed. She's appeared on CBS This Morning, on Good Morning America, on NPR's All Things Considered 2020, among others. And I'm so excited to have her here to talk with me today about parenthood in the modern age. Welcome, Kim.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I was just going to start with a personal story that at the same time as reading your book, I was reading Beezus and Ramona, which was written by Beverly Cleary in 1955 to my older two boys. And in Beezus and Ramona, in most of Beverly Cleary's books, she talks a lot about what it's like to be a child. And so in this book, Beezus and Ramona are kind of tootling about town. Beezus is age 9 and Ramona's age 4. And they're like mostly on their own. They have a stay-at-home parent, but so many of the chapters are them kind of going off, going to the store. Beez is going to her art class and leaving Ramona in the sandbox. And it was just such a contrast to be reading your book and to be sort of thinking about how parenting was so very different a few decades ago. And in your book, you talk about this experience that really brings to life how much culture has evolved since the 1950s, and which clearly was a pivotal point in your life. So I was wondering if you could just start us off by talking us through what happened the day of the event that really forms the crux and sort of the starting point of your book.
Sure. Well, in some ways it started with a similar kind of conundrum or observation as the one you're describing, of thinking about the past and past norms around parenting and sort of a confusion with that. So this was, I guess, at this point about 6 years ago now. I was visiting my parents in Virginia, kind of the community where I grew up. I live in Chicago now. And I had brought my two kids with me. And my son at the time was about 4 and a half. And the last day there, we were getting ready to go back to the airport to fly home. And I realized that I needed a new pair of headphones. There was a certain type of headphones that he liked to wear on the plane that didn't bother his ears. And so he wanted to come with me. I took him to the store and, we arrived there and he asked if he could wait in the car while I ran in. He was in a particularly difficult store phase, where he was like very overwhelmed and was, begging for every toy and piece of candy. And it ended up always being very stressful. And so, in the back of my mind, I was thinking about my own childhood in this kind of rural suburban community and all of the times that I would wait in the car for 5 minutes or much longer, actually, while my parents would run into a store. And I didn't sit there and ponder it for an hour. I just said, okay, and it was a cool day, it was maybe in the 50s. So I left the windows a little bit open, and I ran into the store. I got the one item. I came back a few minutes later and we went home and we went back to Chicago. And I didn't think anything of it until I got home and I learned that apparently somebody had seen me do this, had seen me run into the store without him, had recorded the incident and had called the police, who then showed up in the parking lot after I had already left. But they used the license plate on the car, which was my mother's car, to sort of track her down and then to use that to track me down. And they wanted to talk to me about what had happened. So that incident sort of launched something that went on for about a year and a half, almost 2 years, where at first I had no idea what would come of it, or if I had done anything wrong, what that thing might be. Eventually I was charged with a crime, the crime of contributing to the delinquency of a minor, which was a misdemeanor. And I ended up having to do a number of things to have this charge dropped. I had to go back to Virginia. I had to go to court. And so, you know, to say the least, it was very upsetting at the time, especially in the short term. But in the longer term, it was also very disorienting and very confusing. And it sort of got me thinking for the first time about how starkly kind of norms around childhood and childhood safety have changed just in the course of one generation. And that was sort of the starting point for the book, was the incident, yes, but really more than the incident itself, the ways in which the incident made me start questioning these kind of sociological shifts.
This sense that parenting has changed so much in the course of one generation is really an experience that most of us who are parents now can relate to. You know, most of us were left in the car when we were young, or were given opportunities to run to the store. And now it's really frowned upon. And not only is it frowned upon, I mean, what your experience suggests is it's criminal. It can be considered a criminal act. And you talk in your book that the laws vary from state to state. And certainly there are some issues of racism and classism that come up, and we'll get to those later. But in some sense, what used to be considered so normal is really now considered to be delinquent parenting. Mm-hmm. And you talk a bit about sort of why that evolution in your exploration in your book, you really explore some of the reasons for that evolution. And I wonder if you can talk us through some of those.
Yeah, sure. You know, there are a number of different reasons which I explore. I'll kind of go into some of the biggest ones, the most obvious ones. What I learned was that, first of all, during the 1980s, late 70s through the early 90s, there was sort of a child safety scare, or sort of moral panic surrounding children and strangers. And this was sort of the birth of like the Stranger Danger campaign. There were a few very high profile, horrendous kidnapping cases, like Adam Walsh, for example, Eitan Patz, these terrible instances of children being abducted and killed by strangers, which, you know, horrendous as they were, very, very, very uncommon, but they got a tremendous amount of media attention. And I think that, you know, those cases and the attention they got, combined with the sort of general anxiety that was in the air during the 80s and 90s around motherhood and parenthood, and a lot of women going back into the workforce, you know, no social safety nets or social supports to sort of fill in those gaps. There was this sense of who's watching the children, who's parenting the children. There are these bad people out there. There are these dangerous others who are lurking around and want to steal our children. I think sort of created this perfect storm of anxiety, misogyny, and sort of sex panic, which all sort of converged to, I think, instill this sense in people by, you know, the early aughts or the late 90s, that children are not safe in public spaces, that a child who is not being directly observed or supervised in a public space is somehow at peril. And it's weird because I say this and it's like, so many people agree with this and accept this now, right? That like as though it's a thing that's always been the case. But in fact, it's really very new. And just 30 or 40 years ago, it would not, if you can think about this for a second, that it would not have been strange at all to see a child waiting in a car, to see a child, you know, an 8-year-old child walking to school on their own. It would have been completely commonplace. And so in just a few decades, we've gotten from where something that seemed, that was absolutely commonplace is now so unusual that it causes people often to panic and call the police as though they're seeing something terrible or terribly dangerous happening.
You go into the statistics in your book with some detail is that so there's a phenomenon called the availability heuristic, which is when something that we're sort of presented with and presented with in a very stark way becomes in a sense something that we think happens all the time because it's so impressed upon our psyches. But what you talk about is that the sense that crime has gone up, that dangers to our children have gone up, it isn't matched by what the statistics say, that in fact, the dangers to our children have gone down, if anything. Children and the world is a safer place than it used to be. But because we're so inundated with images from social media and from the news and from conversations with peers and colleagues, we have this sense of the danger growing, even though that doesn't actually map onto what's really happening in our society.
Yeah, or how the way that I would actually put it, you know, a few years ago, I might have said the danger has decreased or is less dangerous, but I've changed my thinking a little bit on this now. What I say now is the danger has changed, and the danger is not what we think it is. So like right now, I'm working on a piece for The Times about the rise in child suicide. One of the greatest risks, one of the greatest causes of unnatural death for children under 12 is now, or I'm sorry, under, I'm going to get the statistics a little wrong. I'll have to fact check them later. But I think that under 16 is suicide. So there's a huge mental health crisis, for example, among children. There's a crisis with obesity. Children are literally getting diabetes, you know, getting serious illnesses from these things. So mental illness, depression, anxiety, obesity, there are real risks to our children, but it's not the stranger in the white van. It's not the pedophile down the street. And those are the kind of risks that we cling to. I think you're right. I learned about this through writing the book, The Availability Heuristic. It was very interesting to me. And I guess, tell me if I'm wrong, but the way I came to understand it is it just means that people are very bad at gauging statistics and statistical risks. So the way that we understand how risky we think something is how easily we can recall an example. And so I think that that's what's happened is that these very unusual but horrible cases of bad things happening to children at the hands of strangers, because they're disseminated so widely, because they're publicized so widely, it's very easy to think of an example. And so it starts to feel like it's something that is a really significant risk when in fact it's not.
Yeah. And I think too that the availability heuristic is influenced by how disturbing an image is. And it might be less disturbing to think about a kid becoming a little bit overweight or sedentary and comparatively much more disturbing to think about somebody being assaulted or kidnapped. And so when we sort of position those images side by side, the one that has more of the startle effect is going to come more easily to our consciousness when we think about the dangers that are facing our children.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the cognitive scientists who I interview in the book, I think we were going to just talk about her later, but Barbara Sarnecka sort of explained it in this very colorful way to me that I really liked, which was like, she said that our brains evolved over thousands of years to be most attuned to things that could kill us quickly and very suddenly, right? Like a bear jumping out from a cave or something like that. We're not programmed to worry about things that kill us very slowly over time, you know, through creeping despair. And so she said, you know, and so that's why there's no CSI diabetes unit. you know, because it's just, those aren't the things that we seem to like be primed to focus on. Whereas things like child murder or abduction are sort of, as horrific as they are, there's a part of our brain that like likes to ruminate on those kinds of horror stories. Whereas the much more mundane, boring threats of sort of our, you know, demoralizing and sedentary lifestyles are not, you know, don't quite get us going in the same way.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing to think about, sort of what captures our attention is the stuff that's exciting, but not the stuff that actually is more likely, statistically likely. And so our attention gets pulled to these things that are far less likely to happen, and we tend to ignore some of the things that are far more risky for us and for our children. And so I think, you know, the takeaway is that there are many takeaways, but one of the takeaways that I think is really important is that our concern about our kids not being under our watchful eye is sort of overhyped compared to the actual risk that they encounter from not being under our watchful eye. And we'll talk a little bit more about sort of like the risks of always being watched in just a moment, because I think that that's a really important piece that we also don't spend much time and energy on. But I actually wonder if before we could go on, I thought the parts of your book where you go into Barbara Czarnecka's research on fear and judgment is really interesting. So I wonder if you could actually summarize some of her research on why we judge parents who leave their children unattended and sort of what her findings suggest.
Sure. Yeah. I found it fascinating too. So the way that she became interested in the subject, I think, is very telling, which is she had a somewhat similar incident as I did, not quite at this level, but when her son was, I think, 8 or 9, she wanted to let him play in the school playground, or not the playground of the park across the street from his school, for 45 minutes with the other kids and then pick him up there after work. And she got all this pushback from the school, from other parents, people calling the principal saying she was being irresponsible. You know, she wasn't there watching her child with all the other parents, which of course she thought was absurd. And, she was really disturbed by it. But eventually she sort of put it out of mind, and it only remembered it, you know, later on when she read about my story. And then at the same time, her son was getting his learner's permit to learn to drive. And she told me, you know, what was shocking to her is that nobody gave her a hard time about this, right? Like nobody was like, I can't believe you're letting your 16-year-old get a driver's license. Don't you know how many teenagers are killed behind wheels in this country every day? This is a terrible idea. This is so dangerous. It was just completely accepted that, of course, this was a thing that she was going to do. And so she was trying to figure out why there was this discrepancy. And what she did with this study that she designed was she wanted to see what was really upsetting people in this situation where they see an unsupervised child. Because she said, okay, if it's not risk, if it's not rational risk that the child's being placed in, then like what is going on? And so she did this experiment where with her team of colleagues, where they would ask people about different scenarios where they might come upon an unsupervised child in a car, you know, on a cool day in like a covered garage. And they would ask them to rate the level of risk they thought the child was being put in, and then also the level of sort of their moral judgment toward the parent, like how bad a thing was the parent doing. And then what she did was she altered the reasons that the children had been left. So in one case, for example, they'd say, well, the mother was returning the grocery cart to the carrel and was hit by a car and struck unconscious, right? Or in another case, the parent was running into the office to give their boss an important document. In another case, the parent was visiting a lover or, you know, going to hang out with a friend for a few minutes or something. And so, of course, you know, she would expect the moral judgment to change depending on the parent's reason for leaving the kids, which she did. But what she also found, which is the really surprising and interesting thing about the study, is not only did their moral judgment change, but the level of risk that they assessed the child being placed in changed, which makes no sense, right? Like, regardless of the reason, a child left in the same location for a set amount of time, the risk doesn't go up whether the parent was going to see a lover or struck unconscious, right? But in people's minds, it changed. So a person actually thought the child being left for what they deemed a bad reason was at more risk than the child who was left for what they deemed a good reason. They also found, very interestingly, that a father who left the child to run into work was seen as equivalent to someone who left the child because they were struck unconscious, right? Reasons beyond their control. A mother who left the child to run into work was viewed more like going to see a friend or a lover, something optional and thus irresponsible. So that's maybe my favorite part of the entire study.
Yeah, such a gender bias that happens when we judge how parents attend to their kids. And it's a really interesting thing, you know, in terms of how we evaluate how good of a parent somebody is. And you give some really, I think, just surprising anecdotes.
You know, a lot of what we pretend is about child safety is really about judging and policing women, I think, and mothers. It's disturbing. And you know, I guess to sort of loop back to your earlier question about how these changes happen so quickly, the great insight that I gleaned from Sarnecka's work is that what happened because of this relationship then between moral judgment and risk assessment, I think a sort of negative feedback loop formed in these decades where, you know, we get these high profile cases that make people start thinking more about child safety in public spaces. And then suddenly when you see a child alone or unsupervised, you think it's dangerous, so people start to judge those parents as being bad parents or bad mothers who are doing that. And then because we start to judge parents, we think it's more dangerous than it is. And it sort of forms a loop. And that's, as one sociologist, Joel Bess, described to me, a recipe for very rapid social change.
Yeah. It is amazing to think that, you know, something that was so commonplace in the 50s or even when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s is now a criminal act. It sort of boggles the mind. And I think what this research, Sarnecka's research, really shows is that it's not based in actual danger. It's based in, as you're describing, this sort of loop that creates this fear, that creates this rationalization of this fear, that creates laws. And it's right. Sort of, it really does just change the landscape of our culture and the way that we're expected and we're permitted to parent.
And interestingly, I should add, in many cases, it hasn't even created new laws. And that was the situation with my case, because that's why I was charged with contributing to the delinquency to a minor. What often happens in these cases is that, and this was the case in Virginia, that there's no law against letting your child wait in a cool car for 5 minutes. There's no law against letting your child walk to the park unsupervised, because these things were not seen as criminal, you know, not very long ago. So what the police do is when someone calls and says, I think I'm seeing something that's inappropriate or dangerous, and, you know, if the police decide to pursue it, they have to sort of grope for some law that fits the bill, you know? So in my case, like, I was lucky, and I do think, you know, privilege and race and class plays into this. They didn't want to charge me with a felony like child neglect, or child endangerment. So they wanted to charge me with something less severe, a misdemeanor. So they charged me with contributing to the delinquency of a minor. So I think that that's interesting that in many cases, there aren't even laws even without the laws on the books, we've sort of criminalized a lot of these behavior.
It can breed a response that doesn't fit the action that it's intended to. So we're talking a bit about how the fear has been fabricated, but what I want to also spend some time talking about is how it impacts both parents and kids in terms of how we parent and how our kids grow. So let's first talk about how it impacts our children. So on the one hand, our intentions are so pure, right? We're trying to protect these small creatures that we've brought into the world and raise them as safely as we can, given the dangers that do exist. And even if we are sort of overblowing them, wouldn't that be better, right? There's this sort of belief that there's no action that we could take that would be too much if it's in the service of protecting our children. And in your book, you actually take a very different approach to thinking that line of logic through. And I think it's a really important one in terms of really evaluating the opportunity cost, that every choice that we make has some opportunity cost. So how do you understand what it means for our children and their childhoods to take this approach of being so present and so careful about keeping them in our vision and always protecting them and always making sure that they're safe at all times?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, I like to sort of start by thinking about what the costs and benefits of the same choices would be for adults, right? Because, and I think that that's the first place where we've sort of gone wrong as a culture, in sort of dehumanizing children in this strange way, both exalting them and sacralizing them and making them like our gods, but also sort of dehumanizing them. They're not people. They don't deserve the same rights and freedoms as people. So I think like about myself, I mean, I live in Chicago. I live in a nice neighborhood, but it is in the city. And we've had in the last year, there have been like a couple muggings. Okay. There was even a shooting about a year ago. So every time I go outside to walk to the store, to walk to the gym, to walk to the coffee shop, I'm taking some risk. I'm taking some risk that I could be mugged or killed or something terrible could happen. So I could bring that risk down to zero by never leaving my home. Right. But most people would agree that that would not be a mentally healthy choice for me to make, that if I were to decide, no, I can't deal with that risk that I might be, you know, mugged or shot and killed, so I'm just going to stay home all the time and use, you know, Uber Eats or whatever. If I said that, most people would say, well, you're clinically depressed, you know, or you have a mental illness, or if you don't, you're going to have a mental illness. And because even though there's some risk to leaving your home, to be healthy, we have to do it and we have to live our lives, right? So why is it when we're talking about children, that doesn't seem obvious? You know, that yes, of course, we can never let children do anything on their own. We can watch them constantly, observe them constantly, not give them freedom or independence or any kind of autonomy. And we can, by doing that, reduce certain risks. But it should, I think, if you just think about it, seem obvious that we're doing it at great cost to their mental health and their sense of well-being. And then we actually see that playing out in, as I was mentioning, in the statistics around childhood mental health.
You describe a study that was conducted by two authors that I've actually had on the show, Miriam Liss and Holly Schifrin, and they talk, they did an assessment of college students and looked at how sort of much helicopter parenting those college students have. And those who describe parents as being really sort of, you know, overly engaged in their lives and kind of taking care of everything had more depression and less of a sense of self-competency. And that is just sort of one specific study that really demonstrates some of the effects that this over-parenting and sort of being overly careful with our kids' risks can have.
Yeah. And I think also just for healthy development and also for happiness, you know, or just a sense of the ability to experience joy. I mean, something else that Barbara had said to me in our interviews was that they do these studies to determine what makes people happy, right? And it's never what we think it's going to be. Like, you know, people will say, oh, having a lot of money or having a great marriage or whatever, a lot of status. But it turns out that the thing that actually determines how happy people are is how much they have an internal versus an external locus of control, which just means the ability to say, I want to do X, Y, or Z to be able to do that thing, right? As opposed to always having some boss or warden or parent or teacher who's telling you how to spend your time, that makes people very, very unhappy. And she said that to me, and I sort of was thinking, well, if that's the case, then our kids must be pretty miserable, because no matter how sort of privileged they are now, no matter how much, you know, affluence or how many resources they have, in fact, sometimes even if they have a lot of resources, that's the one thing they're deprived of, is any sort of autonomy, any sort of ability to decide what they do and how they spend their time. That was disturbing.
It is disturbing. And I actually do think that there's a correlation, because I think that the more privilege a lot of our kids have, it can these days to be accompanied by a loss of freedom. You know, the more privilege people have, the more classes they seem to be signed up for, and the more likely they are to have, you know, if not a parent that's ever present, to have some kind of a caregiver that's always watching them, and therefore not a lot of private time to sort of do their own thing as kids, you know, ideally would want to have. The other side of it is, I think it really has an impact on the quality of life for parents if we have this pressure. And I think it's this a similar idea of loss of this locus of control. If we feel like we're constantly being expected to do things because we have to do them, or else fear, you know, dire consequence, either from judgment of our peers or from the legal system, that if we aren't watching our kids and giving up all of our own, you know, activities and desires in order to have a watchful eye on them. And I think that really does decrease the quality of life. And you talk a little bit about some of the cross-cultural studies that have been done, or maybe it was more anecdotal, but it kind of reminded me of this great book that I'm often bringing up called Bringing Up Bebe by Pamela Druckerman. And she talks about what parenting is like in France versus in the States. And it's just a really different culture, where in France, parents, including mothers, are really expected to pursue their own interests. And in so doing, they actually do give their children a lot of freedom, and it tends to improve quality of life on both sides.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a balance that most people want to strike, right? And some of this, I think, is a reaction against, again, like my generation, you know, people who grew up in the 80s, the 70s, or earlier. You know, I think there was often, because a lot of women were going back into the workforce, and because we hadn't as a society sort of figured out what to do about that and how to support women and support families with working mothers, I think a lot of us didn't feel very seen. We didn't feel very like our needs were always being considered. You know, there was a lot of divorce, a lot of acrimonious divorce. Like, I was a latchkey kid for a number of years. I'd come home and watch like soap operas for 2.5 hours by myself, you know, and eat bagel dogs on the couch. And I think there is this tendency for some people on the, you know, side of free range parenting to sort of romanticize that complete freedom that people might have had 30, 40 years ago. And I try to like not do that, because I do think children need to be seen and considered and loved and, you know, given sort of a certain amount of attention. But I think what's happened is, maybe in part in reaction to that, people who grew up like that, who have kids now today, there's this sense of like, well, I'm not going to be that sort of absentee parent who's more concerned with myself. I'm going to be there all the time. I'm going to be at every practice. I'm going to be at every game. I'm going to be at every birthday party. And we've had this extreme pendulum shift. And I don't think that extreme is any healthier than the other extreme, right? I mean, for me, like the moment where I mean, there have been a lot of moments where I felt the impact on my quality of life, but like one that sticks out in my mind is I was at this, my daughter had been invited to a classmate's birthday party. I think she was like in the second grade or something. And the birthday party, I could write a whole nother book about children's birthday parties and the strange culture around that and how that's evolved. But this party was at like a princess dance studio. And so, of course, like I assumed it was just going to be a drop off party. You know, my kid was like 7 or 8 and it was at a dance studio. And I thought, great, I'm going to go get a little work done at the coffee shop down the street. And I go there and I realize, no, all of the parents, all of the mothers anyway, are staying at this party. And half of them, maybe even more, are like putting on tutus because they're expected to like do the dancing, the ballet with their 6-year-old daughters, which I know it sounds like maybe that sounds wonderful, but I didn't want to put on a tutu and do ballet, you know, with my daughter. Like I'm a working mom. I have very limited time. If I'm going to spend time with my daughter, I want it to be quality time with the two of us, you know, going for a walk or making cookies or something. I didn't want to put on a tutu, but I felt socially compelled to do this. And I just sort of won. And then I sort of looked around and I could tell that there were other mothers who really didn't want to be doing this. And it was a sense of like, why are we all doing this? You know, nobody wants to do this. The kids don't really seem to care that we're here. And so there was just this, I think there's a lot of this sort of social coercion that goes on around parenthood with, again, usually with women. And I do think there's a real difference. I don't know if there's a difference in what's expected, but I think there's a strong difference in the consequences of not meeting those expectations. You know, I think that fathers have more flexibility, more room to say, oh, I'm not going to do that, or I'm going to just opt out of that activity or that responsibility, and people kind of give them a pass. Whereas with mothers, there's more punishment, so social punishment when that goes on.
I agree. Well, so I have many thoughts about what you're saying, including that I want to tell you, you should definitely write a book about birthday parties because they are an enigma to me, and I have a lot of strong feelings that we don't have time for about them. But I think that the gender difference in how social judgments both take place and how we receive them and how we respond to them is really worthy of exploration, because I think part of it is that mothers are more judged. And I also think that part of it is that we care more about the judgment. And what I've sort of started to explore is like, what happens if you feel judged and you just say, so be it, and then you sort of make a choice anyway, even if it's going to bring judgment. And I think it's sort of like the bark is worse than the bite. I think the fears that we have about the social judgment, I'm not talking about sort of legal action or anything like that, are much bigger than the actual consequences. But because women are socialized more relationally, we tend to care more. And we tend to therefore respond more strongly and in ways that reduce the judgment so that we can kind of protect ourselves. But I really encourage people listening to really reflect on like what would happen if you noticed your fear of judgment and then really ask yourself, but what do I really want to do? And then follow that line of behavior, do what makes more sense for you and see how it feels. See if some of the things that you fear really do come true. And this is actually something that I'm kind of actively working on myself, because I feel those pressures a lot. I'm a mom of 3. I work. I'm a psychologist, and I constantly, and I'm a people pleaser. So I'm constantly faced with this sense of, you know, what people are going to think I'm a bad mom if I don't chaperone, or people are going to think I'm a bad mom if I don't host a birthday party, or people are going to think I'm a bad mom. And I'm always bringing up this example on the podcast. People are going to think I'm a bad mom when I don't have my kids do thank you cards. But for me, it's so taxing that I've just decided I'm going to experiment with what it's like not to do those things. And I'm going to know that it'll be uncomfortable for me. And I'm going to know that if the judgment feels too much to bear, I can always make a different choice the next time. And it turns out that most of the time, and it could just be my own circumstances that I have a pretty generous community, the consequences that I fear don't actually happen. And so I really encourage people, and this is sort of where I wanted us to end, is talking about sort of what we can do within this culture that has evolved, right? Because there are some things top down that I think should be done from a policy level, from a legal level, but I think that there's also tremendous power from an individual level to make our own independent choices and impact the culture from the grassroots up.
I mean, I love this question. I think this is really important. And just before I kind of get into the meat of my answer, I just want to say also, I mean, it took me, I think, 3 years of therapy to stop writing thank you notes, because I can so relate to that, you know, and I would agonize over it, right? Like, I don't want to write 25 thank you notes for my 4-year-old's gifts, you know, and how can I be expected to do this? But I have to do it, because what will people think? And you know, now it's like, people come, if they come to a party, and they hand me a gift, which we don't ask for, I just say, thank you so much. By the way, I don't write thank you notes, but thank you. I take their hand sometimes. Thank you. I'm thanking you right now. I'm glad you asked this question, because this is the question that I get asked the most at readings. And as I've been promoting this book, is a lot of women will come up to me and they'll say, they've read some of my work, or they've read Lenore Skenazy or Peter Gray, and they'll say, I think that you are right. I want to give my kid more freedom, both for the sake of my child, also for my own sake, but I'm afraid to do it because I know that the other parents at the park are going to gossip, or I'm afraid they'll think I'm a bad mom, or this or that consequence. And they, what should I do? They always ask me, I'm never exactly sure how to respond, because it's as though they want me to, you know, to tell them how to change other people's views of them and the world. And of course, nobody can do that, right? I mean, or maybe we can do it in the long term, and like you said, in terms of dedicating ourselves to advocacy and top-down reform. But like on a day-to-day level, we can't change what other people think or what they do. We can only change ourselves. And so I just sort of started saying to people when they ask me this, you just have to not care that much. You know, you just have to... Exactly the way you describe it. You know, if you feel like it's absolutely appropriate for your 7-year-old to walk to the park that's down the street and play there for 30 minutes, you have to not care if other moms or other whoever or other, you know, people passing by think that that's a bad choice. Now, of course, it's harder not to care, as you say, if you're also worried they're going to call Child Protective Services or the police. That's sort of another issue. But often that's not the fear. The fear is just of being judged. And so that's what I say, is that, you know, we have to learn to not care so much what strangers think of us. I also say to myself, like, someone who is going to judge me in that way without knowing me, without knowing my child, without knowing my situation, is not somebody I want to be friends with or have any kind of relationship with anyway. I think that that's a great way to think of it, as this opportunity for sort of personal grassroots empowerment, that, you know, doing what you know is best for your children and for yourself, and doing it regardless of what other people may or may not think, is a really kind of socially, politically empowering thing that we can all do.
Yeah, absolutely. It really fits into this therapeutic practice that I and the other two co-hosts of this podcast all do, which is called acceptance and commitment therapy, which really emphasizes identifying your own values and behaviors that would sort of embody those values, and engaging in those behaviors even when uncomfortable emotions come up. And of course we get uncomfortable when we feel judged, but the problem is that all human brains are wired to judge. So there actually is no avoiding it. And because we're, and maybe women are more sensitive to that judgment, we're going to encounter it no matter what we do. We can, and I think this is a part of the anxiety of parenting, is that no matter how hard we try, we still feel judged, because there's always going to be judgment. It may be more potent now than it ever has before, but no matter what we do, we can't eliminate the way that other people are going to sort of evaluate our behavior, in part because they're unsure about how they want to parent, and they're sort of trying to make the best choices for themselves and using our example as something to bounce their own ideas off of. I mean, you get it, and you gave this really lovely example of, I think it was a group of like three sets of parents having conversations at the dinner table. And so like some kids had a phone while they were waiting, some kids had crayons, and some kids didn't have anything at all. And every set of parents was probably judging the other sets of parents, because that's a part of what we do. And I think, just as you're saying, it can really benefit us and empower us to say, you know, people are going to judge, and it doesn't serve me well to spend too much time agonizing over it. The better thing to do is to really clarify how it makes sense for me to parent, given who I am, given who my kid is, given what my circumstances are, and given sort of what my objectives are, and then make choices with that in mind, knowing that along the way, you're going to feel that discomfort of other people judging.
Yeah, I think that's great. And the other thing that I just sort of add to that when I'm talking about that is that I think that that's part of good parenting too, is modeling moral courage and independent thinking for our kids. You know, there's so much emphasis now on giving kids the skills they need to get into an elite college, right? Or to get a good career path, and not enough focus on sort of, I think, social emotional learning and sort of moral development, right? And I think it's a good opportunity. You know, like my son we still have this conversation sometimes where, you know, he'll say, you know, why can't I do that? Is it because, you know, is it because it's really dangerous, or because it's just people think it's dangerous? And, you know, and we'll talk about the distinction, you know, and how we try to whenever we can, to go by our own moral compass, right? And to make our own decisions. But sometimes we do live in society and we do live in the world. And there are some situations where we have to kind of compromise, but we try not to. And I think those are important conversations to have with our kids, you know, that sometimes we have to do things that are uncomfortable for us because we know that they're right, you know, that it's what we believe in. And that we're not, you know, we're not modeling good behavior if our children constantly see us just sort of bowing down to social expectation. And I think they notice things like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I also just want to make explicit that I love the message that you're sending about moderation, that we don't want to sort of pendulum swing to overprotection or to underprotection, but somewhere in the middle. And we don't want to overswing to, you know, we should only do what everybody else wants to. We should only do what we want, you know, without considering the cultural context, that it's good to find some balance between them and to make sure that we aren't getting too extreme, because that's where things, I think, get quite unhealthy for us and for our kids. And I think, by the way, that it's such an interesting thing to think about you now parenting and sort of bringing those conversations up with your kid. And so I was going to ask more explicitly, how has your parenting changed over the course of writing and maybe even promoting this book and hearing, you know, knowing the research and having interviews with parents who've gone through similar things that you've gone through?
I mean, I think largely in the way that you were just discussing with, you know, it's not that I still don't have irrational fears or anxieties involving my children. Like, I don't think there's any amount of Prozac that could eliminate those. But I feel like I've become more mindful of them and more conscious, and that, you know, I'm able now to sort of notice when I'm having irrational fears or anxieties and make a choice whether or not I'm going to capitulate to those fears, as opposed to sort of just doing so automatically. You know, that's been the big change. But then there are really, I think, concrete things also that I do let I do let my son do that I probably wouldn't have if I never had written this book or had these experiences. I mean, he's 12. He's masterful at public transportation in Chicago. He takes the bus by himself. He takes the L by himself. He has a much better sense of direction than I do. And, you know, it's not that I think letting him do these things are completely without risk. But, you know, I think that the benefits that he gleans from feeling that, you know, we have this confidence in him and getting to feel like that he's an able, you know, competent person who can do this kind of navigation on his own outweighs, you know, the risks. And which is not to say I always take that approach. I mean, one big battle between us right now is that, you know, he rides his bike and he wants, you know, I've told him he can't ride on the street with bike lanes, you know, unless I'm right there. And even when I'm there, we can't go on certain streets that I think are too dangerous. And, you know, he finds this infuriating, right? Why can't he ride his bike any place that an adult rides his bike? And we talk about it, and I say, because it's dangerous, you know, because bikes and one of the greatest dangers we all face is, you know, bad drivers and distracted drivers. And this is a real risk. And so it's definitely not like I'm, you know, this no fear parent or anything. I mean, actually, in fact, this is funny. Like, I don't know if you, did you hear about this a few years ago? There was this this case that got some attention where a woman, a couple who, they were sailors and they loved to sail, and they took their like 6-month-old and 2-year-old and they were going to sail around the world with their baby and their 2-year-old. And then about 2 days out at sea, the baby got sick. And they had to be rescued by the Coast Guard. And there was a lot of uproar, like who would take these kids, you know, these little kids sailing around the world. And it was interesting. The woman actually emailed me after my book came out and, you know, was saying how grateful she was that I was writing about this, about how, you know, counterproductive fear is and we should be able to do whatever we want with our children. And of course, I was grateful to her for the kind words. But I couldn't help but thinking I would never sail around the world. I mean, even by myself, I don't do things like, you know, I don't whitewater raft or do those kinds of things. But, you know, I thought that would terrify me. The thought of being on any boat with like a baby just absolutely would terrify me. So it's not that I've become this incredibly courageous parent, but I do think I've gotten better at seeing anxiety and fear for what it is, you know, and kind of living with it as opposed to just always bowing down before it.
So instead of letting it direct your actions, you sort of acknowledge what it is and then try to make more value-driven choices. And I just want to sort of dovetail on that, because as you're talking, it sort of makes me think of the different things that scare us and how different it is from parent to parent. Because I'll let my children ride out in the street. We live on a relatively safe street, but there's this corner around which another parent who lives right across the street won't let her children ride around, and my kids do. And I was initially worried about it because of the bad drivers. And then my husband made the point, well, they need to learn to manage themselves with drivers on the road, and it's a skill that they're going to build. Now, somebody might be listening to this, and maybe you're even listening to this and saying, like, what a bad parent. But that's a risk that I'm choosing to take, and there will be judgment. And then I have another friend who's an excellent cook, and her 8-year-old uses a chef's knife to like chop things. And I would never let my children chop things with a very sharp knife. Like, that makes me so nervous. But for her, it's a really valuable skill, and she's willing to tolerate the risk because it's just that important for her. And then there are, you know, a variety of other choices that parents will make because for them, the risk makes sense in the context of their lives, in the context of their children, and based on like what their goals are for their kids. And I think it is one of those things that we're always going to judge one another because we're just different, and what matters to us differs, and what risks we're willing to tolerate for what purpose is going to differ from parent to parent. And like you're saying, like for you, it wouldn't have made sense to take a small child sailing, but for that other person, maybe it did. And I think it just really speaks to sort of the individual choices that we have to make, and I love this free-range parenting idea, but I do think that it's nice to sort of think about it as something that really is going to differ from person to person based on the circumstances and what risks make sense to tolerate.
Yeah, I think that's very true, you know, and I think we certainly all, we're all human and we're all allowed to have our own, you know, idiosyncratic fears and anxieties. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. But, the problem, and I think the main problem that I'm writing about in the book is what happens when we take these particular irrational fears and we normalize them, and then we criminalize in different ways people who don't sort of adhere to that fear. So I guess another way of saying that is when we really get in trouble is when we stop seeing fear for what it is. When we start thinking that our fears are reality, that's when we get in trouble. Because, you know, fear is a real thing, but fear lies. Fear doesn't always tell us the truth about reality.
Absolutely. I wonder if you can actually, before we go, give the example that, I think, again, this comes from Barbara Sonecka, but her wheelchair example, because it's such a great example of this fear taken to its logical extreme.
Yeah, I loved that example she gave too. Sure. Yeah, she was saying that, you know, I'm trying to remember how she set it up exactly. I think she was saying that, you know, you can imagine a scenario where a certain number of children in this country probably fall down while they're playing each year and hit their head and die, right? It might not be a large number, but surely, you know, with all the children in this country, once or twice this happens where a kid falls and dies. And she said, well, if you know what we're doing now, then you can imagine a scenario where, you know, people start to say, well, any risk of something like that happening to a child is too great a risk. So we're just going to, from now on, we're going to start to put able-bodied children in wheelchairs just to make sure that no child falls down and dies. And she said, well, and then you can imagine if we started doing that for a number of years, it might actually start to seem strange if you saw a child who was walking, who was not wheelchair bound. And then you'd have schools would start to say, well, you know, if most of the kids are in wheelchairs, if what kid falls down, they're going to ask, why weren't all the kids in wheelchairs? And so then schools start to develop policies where all children have to be in wheelchairs all the time because you just never know and you can't be too safe. And she kind of goes on and on with this, you know, horrific scenario. And then she stopped and she said, of course, we don't do that because we recognize that children's healthy physical development requires that they do things like walk and run and jump and play. And that were we to confine all children to wheelchairs, it would have very grave physical effects on their physical health and well-being. And she says, but I think that having some freedom and some autonomy is as important to children's psychological well-being as moving around is to their physical well-being. And I think we're sort of doing this horrific experiment on an entire generation of children. And what we're seeing, and this is what I'm writing about now in my journalism, what we're seeing now is soaring rates of depression, anxiety, self-harm, suicide, substance abuse in children all the way from, you know, five-year-olds up through college. And that these are sort of the effects that we're seeing from this experiment.
And on the parent side, I think we're seeing a lot of anxiety, depression, overwhelm, and unhappiness. And I wanted to just share one quote from Alan Watts, who's a philosopher that spent his career translating Eastern philosophy for Westerners. And he writes, "Do we want to be some kind of omnipotent God in control of it all, or do we want to enjoy it instead? After all, we can't enjoy what we are anxiously trying to control." And I think as parents, this emphasis on trying to control the risk really limits our ability to enjoy parenting, which makes it much harder for us to engage in ways that are ultimately helpful for our kids. And I think that that really is a part of what detracts from healthy development and part of what's contributing to some of the things that you're writing about, Kim. So we'll definitely link to your pieces. I'll definitely link to your book. There's so much more content that we didn't have time to get into. For example, we didn't talk at all about the classism and the racism and the effects that some of these expectations of what parents should be doing, how that impacts people who are not of privileged backgrounds or who are racial and ethnic minorities. And it's a really important point, and I'm sorry we didn't have a chance to get to it. And it's just a really fascinating story, and the research that you explore is just really, I think, eye-opening in terms of parenting in the modern age. So I highly recommend the book, and Kim's writing is just really fun to read. Are there any other places that people can find you?
My website, I try to keep it updated with new work, kabrooks.com. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, the usual places. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Psychologists Off the Clock.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock.
You can find us on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not meant to be a substitute for mental health treatment. If you are having a mental health emergency, please dial 911. If you're looking for mental health treatment, please visit the resources on our webpage.
Our website is www.offtheclockpsych.com. That's www.offtheclockpsych.com.